has the day off, it's here and now. The Democratic Party may be on the verge of naming a new national chair, and the top contender right now is Howard Dean. The former governor of Vermont and former presidential candidate became the frontrunner for the job yesterday when state party leaders endorsed him. To talk about this, joining us on the line now from Santa Fe is one of the nation's most prominent Democrats, Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico, also chair of the Democratic Governors Association and a possible presidential candidate in 2008. Governor Richardson, hello.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Let me ask you, first of all, Governor Richardson, is Howard Dean unbeatable at this point?
He's a pretty strong lead. When over 50% of the state chairs endorse you, that's a very insurmountable, probably, lead. However, there's still one-third of the delegates that haven't voted. These are the grassrooters, and it's 2 weeks away, so anything can happen, but I think his lead is pretty strong. He's run a very effective grassroots campaign. He's got the momentum right now, but in any of these races, like in any primaries, anything can happen. What has happened is the Democratic governors have felt that this is a decision that should be made by the grassroots, not by party leaders, not by senators and governors and congressmen. So this process, I think, has allowed the grassroots in the party, those out in the states, delegates, average Democrats, to really voice their view about who they want to lead the party and what the party stands for. So it's been a good process.
I think a lot of people inside and outside the party might be surprised by this. How has a guy whose failure in last year's presidential race was so dramatic, he was dropped so quickly by Democrats, how has this guy, Howard Dean, become the odds-on favorite to win this post and become the public face and the voice of the party?
Well, first of all, he will not become the public voice and face of the party. That's senators, that's governors. He becomes the chief strategist, a party builder. The spokesmen of the party are those that are making Democratic policy, and what we want to emphasize is out in the states, the most innovative policy is being made. But this does not diminish Dr. Dean and Governor Dean's efforts to mobilize a sizable group of Democrats that have stayed with him, a lot of internet Democrats, a lot of grassrooters, younger people that have come into the party, and he's invigorated them, and he carried that race in the primaries to the DNC, potentially the DNC chairmanship.
I'm wondering if you actually feel that Dean's the best choice. Newsweek recently reported in the last few days that you were in a group trying to create a last-ditch plan to let Dean be chairman but to limit his powers. What's your concern about him?
Well, we have always said, the Democratic governors, that there should be a party spokesman and there should be a chief strategist, sort of a CEO. The old model that Governor Rendell of Philadelphia, when he was chairman, and Joe Andrew of Indiana was his deputy. That's what the Democratic governors feel is important, that there be a chief spokesman of the party, but not necessarily on policy, because we think others should be speaking that way, especially in the states. And so that's what we've been advocating. But there was no effort to stop Governor Dean or anybody. There were other important candidates like Senator Bob Kerrey, former Senator Kerrey, that governors were interested in. But we did not want to play the role of kingmakers. We didn't want to dictate to the party faithful. The party has had a defeat, and what we wanted to do was all issues relating to the future direction, not just of the party, but how we rebuild our state parties. How do we build the grassroots, the neighborhoods, the party of the people?
Well,
seems to have been vanquished.
On the concern of direction, isn't there a concern among Democrats that with Dean there's going to be a lurch to the left for the party? And if 2004, the election of 2004, proved anything nationally, the left is not where America's headed.
We believe that the policy of the party is going to be made more so, not in Washington, but at state houses. You've got 22 Democratic governors, 12 in red states, 10 in blue states. Democrats have shown to be elected in the South and the West. And we believe the most innovative policy issues relating to education, health care, National Guard benefits, for instance, here in New Mexico, we're going to pass a life insurance policy for all our New Mexico National Guards and vets that are serving, that the best policy is being made at the state level and policies that Democrats should be proud of, centrist, mainstream, pragmatic policies that put people to work and make our schools better. And we strongly believe, the Democratic governors, that the party has been too Washington-based. So I think Governor Dean shares that goal. But the public face of the party, I think you're going to be seeing, will be moving more to the states.
Governor Richardson, we're out of time. We'd like to ask you more, but we'll have to have you back another day. Bill Richardson, Governor of New Mexico, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow night, President Bush will give his State of the Union address. He'll go before Congress and the nation with the lowest approval ratings of any second-term president since Richard Nixon. Yet he's riding high from Sunday's election in Iraq and from his November election, which he says provided him with a mandate for change. The question is, what will he set out to change over the next 4 years? Tom McCluskey is Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council. In your opinion, Tom, what's the number one issue for President Bush?
Well, the issue that should be number one for the president and the issue which is number one for the president are two different things. Right now, the issue number one for the president is Social Security reform. While that's certainly a very important issue and one that we hope to work with the president on, I think what helped bring him to re-election, which helped deliver more family-friendly congressmen and senators to him, was an issue such as marriage and the protection of marriage. Yet we have not really heard any encouraging words that the president will follow through in this term, but we do hope to see something tomorrow night.
If you had your druthers, what would you like to hear from the president in tomorrow's State of the Union address?
What we'd like to see is, of course, the president to reiterate his support, as he did last year in the State of the Union, for a constitutional amendment to protect marriage. We'd also like to see him support some of the life initiatives that are out there and that have a good chance of passing this year, such as the Child Custody Protection Act, a cloning ban, and even something that would help defund groups that, such as Planned Parenthood. As the president said the other day, taxpayers should not having to pay for abortions.
As you know, in January, the president gave an interview to the Washington Post in which he said he would not lobby the U.S. Senate to pass the constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriage. I'm wondering, on the almost eve of the president's State of the Union address, what your thoughts are on that issue.
The president has been sending mixed messages, I think, and it's unfortunate. He says his reasons for not pushing for a marriage amendment this time around was he didn't think the votes were in Congress for it. Yet his main initiative is Social Security reform, where most definitely the votes aren't in Congress. And after this past election, where value voters helped deliver the president back into the presidency and also helped deliver some family-friendly senators, I think he'd find more support for a marriage amendment than he would for currently for his Social Security reform.
The president, of course, was very vocal about his opposition to gay marriage when out on the campaign trail before November. And as you point out, many people say this was the issue that brought so many evangelical Christians out to vote on Election Day. But here he is 2 months after the election saying there's no reason to press for an amendment defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman because many senators believe the Defense of Marriage Act, which some states have passed so they don't have to recognize same-sex unions, is sufficient all by itself. It sounds like gay marriage isn't even on his agenda at this moment, the president's agenda, that is.
That's true, and I don't know. I don't think it was cynicism last year or political opportunism that the president was pushing for this marriage amendment. I do believe it is something he believes in. But as I said, Social Security reform, yes, it needs to be done. Yet that is a problem that eventually will be 10, 18 years off before a crisis actually does hit. Something like a marriage amendment is needed now before a crisis hits, and it could just be too late if the Supreme Court rules otherwise, if the case ever reaches that far.
Are you satisfied with the possibility that the courts might end up deciding this?
I'm far from satisfied with that possibility, and that's what started the pro-life movement, was the courts, Supreme Court unilaterally deciding that there was a right to an abortion instead of letting the states and voters allow them to decide on themselves. And this is what's happening again, once again, for marriage. What we hope to see is to stop this and let people decide. Every time the people voted on marriage amendments within the states, they won by margins of 60, 70, 80%.
I'm wondering, Tom, you sort of implied that you wonder whether the president's thinking if he'd have Senate support to pass a constitutional amendment. And I'm curious whether you think the president is being defeatist.
It certainly seems that way on the issue of marriage, and that's unfortunate. The marriage amendment has just gained at least four new senators who support it. In the House, we expect to see more support. It's an issue that is an outreach issue to African Americans, to Hispanic Americans, to Catholics, to a number of groups that the Republican Party normally doesn't reach. If the president really wants to solidify the base and grow the base for the Republican Party in the future, while also touching on issues that are important to society's future, support for a marriage amendment seems like an easy go.
Senator Bill Frist says the amendment banning gay marriage won't come to the Senate floor until 2006 at the earliest. Is that soon enough? I take it not.
We'll be pushing for it certainly sooner. We were happy to see the Senate introduce it as SJ Res 1, putting such importance on it. What I'd like to see is a vote until it passes, say, every fall, every September. And that way, when you're doing it both election and non-election years, I think it can more easily show that this is not a political vote, but this is a vote for society, and it's a vote that's needed.
Do you think you have enough support in Congress to get an amendment passed?
Well, even if we do or don't, overall there's four more senators that support the amendment than did before. Yet there are also going to be new senators who are looking at the numbers for the state marriage amendments and possibly changing their mind, or who might be up for reelection and possibly changing their mind. And eventually, this will pass.
I'm wondering, as we begin to close the interview, if I can ask another political question. Right at the top of the interview, you expressed your disappointment over the fact that the president has placed reforming Social Security at the top of his agenda ahead of dealing with the gay marriage issue. And as you know, a coalition of conservative groups have sent a letter to White House tactician Karl Rove saying it was disappointed that the White House had put Social Security ahead of same-sex marriage. And I'm wondering about the politics of this. Is it a threat or a promise? No support from the White House for outlawing gay marriage, then no support for the White House on Social Security from conservative groups such as yours?
No, I think that would be – it would politically hurt both sides if family groups were to leave themselves out of such an important debate. And while Social Security reform, as I said before, is very, very important, it's not that one should replace the other. We're just hopeful that the president will support both initiatives, both for Social Security reform and for a marriage amendment. When it comes to Social Security reform, that's where the president has political capital – where he needs to spend up on Capitol Hill. When it comes to a marriage amendment, we'll look for him more to use the bully pulpit and to, when he's addressing especially national offices, to make this issue to the forefront.
Tom McCluskey, Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Just ahead, the showdown in Virginia over same-sex marriage. It's put the Democratic governor in a politically delicate place. There's more coming up here and now. Bob Oakes, it's here and now. As conservatives look to President Bush to be more vocal about his opposition to same-sex marriage, they're also very busy at state capitals around the country. Recently, an article in the Boston Globe identified Virginia as ground zero in the debate. Nina Easton, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, wrote that story. Hello, Nina.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
Fine, thank you. Let me ask you, first of all, what makes Virginia ground zero in the battle over same-sex marriage?
Well, a couple things. First of all, about 13 states passed constitutional amendments banning gay marriage last year. Virginia was not one of those. But now they are considering, the legislature there is considering a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, and some of the proposals would also ban civil unions. Why is it ground zero? Well, for one thing, is this battle over this constitutional amendment after the election, at a time when these, just months after these ballot measures passed overwhelmingly in another number of states. Secondly, Virginia's it's a southern state. Democrats know that they have to make inroads in the South if they are ever going to achieve winning the White House. Virginia is particularly interesting because it's a Democratic governor, Mark Warner, and Warner is considered a presidential prospect for 2008. So all eyes are on Virginia to see how is this governor, this Democratic governor, going to deal with this very delicate social issue in the South.
Let me try and get at the Republican point of view for a second here. Why the need for a constitutional amendment when there's already a law on the books in Virginia that recognizes marriage as between a man and a woman? It's called the Affirmation of Marriage Act. Why the need for an amendment?
Well, they're concerned, and fairly realistically, that this will be subject to court challenge. The law that they passed last year, it was not a constitutional amendment, but it was a statute, but it was quite sweeping. It banned gay marriage, civil unions, and partnership contracts between people of the same sex if it looks like it confers marital benefits. It's sort of sweeping language that the gay rights advocates are hoping to get thrown out in court. So I think Republicans, conservative Republicans, and some Democrats want to have a constitutional amendment that would be provide sort of an ironclad ban against gay marriage and civil unions.
In addition to the law just passed, there's a law on the books, already on the books in Virginia, that had already prevented private firms from offering domestic partner benefits. Given that, and given the action on this fairly new law, and given that there's so much debate over the constitutional amendment, it is all of that a sign of how important this issue is to conservatives in Virginia?
Yes, conservatives very much believe that the overwhelming support of these ballot measures last fall demonstrates that their point of view is the majority point of view, and they are determined, they have a mandate, if you will, and they are very determined to go forward on a constitutional amendment in Virginia.
Let's talk about where Governor Warner is on this. He's against gay marriage, but he's tiptoeing around the issue at this moment, isn't he?
He is. And, you know, this has been my experience when I was interviewing a number of Democratic officials from the South. They don't want to touch this issue with a 10-foot pole.
Why?
I think because they don't want to look, particularly if they have national aspirations, they don't want to look intolerant, but neither do they want to look like they are out of sync with social conservatives, many of whom are Democrats, in the South. So it's a very difficult wire for those politicians to walk. And Warner is just, he was reluctant to talk to me about it. He talked to me very briefly about it. He opposed the statute that was passed last year, but he opposed it because of the contract language, not because of the ban on gay marriage or civil unions. So he's taken sort of an economic approach to this, saying that we shouldn't interfere with legal contracts between people. He has opposed the statute on the books that says companies can't offer benefits. Again, an economic issue. We shouldn't be interfering with free markets. But this current battle over a constitutional amendment, I do believe, will force him to take a more clear position.
As I'm listening to you talk about where Warner and the Democrats are on this, one wonders if we aren't seeing a strategy emerging that other Democrats nationally might use.
I think people are looking to him for that. Let's go back to last year, where John Kerry's position on gay marriage was considered not particularly clear, and especially in the South and in more socially conservative areas. There is a desire for some clarity, for some sense that gay marriage is not particularly popular in Southern and Midwest socially conservative states, and the Democrats are really wrestling with how to approach this issue.
Let me come back to the scene in Virginia. Is there political support in the Virginia legislature for a constitutional amendment defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman?
I think there is definitely plenty of support. The legislature is controlled by Republicans, and they will also get some Democrats on board. So even opponents of this ban expect a constitutional amendment to pass. What they are hoping is to keep it narrowly focused just on marriage and not to broaden to civil unions. And that's their strategy.
And might this force Governor Warner to get more vocal?
I'm expecting it to force Governor Warner to get more vocal. I think certainly if he has presidential plans, he's going to need to take a more clear position on this.
Nina Easton, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thanks very much.
Sure.
And this note from Virginia. Yesterday, the House gave preliminary approval to a bill creating specialty license plates that would feature the words traditional marriage on them. The plates would also feature an image of interlocking wedding rings. Several Democrats expressed their objections to the plate, saying they'd be unconstitutional. One Democrat suggested having a plate that would read simply marriage, but that amendment to the measure failed. The bill needs final approval from the House and the Senate and must be signed by the governor before the plates can be sold. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak to a progressive evangelical Christian about gay marriage and more. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. It's Here and Now. The Massachusetts criminal trial of defrocked priest Paul Shanley moves into the defense phase tomorrow. Shanley is accused of sexually abusing a boy in the 1980s while he was a parish priest. The accuser is now 27. Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerov has been following the case. Monica, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bob.
So tell us where we are in the case at this point, Monica.
Well, yesterday the prosecution wrapped up its case after 5 days of testimony, the highlight of which was the alleged victim who was on the witness stand for more than 10 hours. Some of his testimony was very emotional. He broke down crying several times when describing in graphic detail what he says Father Paul Shanley did to him. But then on cross-examination, which took more than 6 hours, he grew very testy and irritated with the defense lawyer. So it was all over the map with the alleged victim. We also heard from some of his classmates in the Sunday school, some Sunday school teachers, and an expert witness for the prosecution about repressed memories, who said, yes, it's common for children who've experienced trauma to repress their memories of it.
The prosecution rested. The defense is up tomorrow. What's the strategy likely to be?
Well, from hearing the defense's opening statements, it sounds like it's going to focus entirely on repressed memories. They're calling in their own expert witness on memories, a woman named Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, who is known for her criticism of evidence based on what she calls false memory. She says it's not possible for people to repress traumatic memories and then recover them years later, as the alleged victim in this case says that he did.
Is it likely or not that Paul Shanley will take the stand in his own defense?
His defense lawyer told me that that's his last resort. He doesn't want to put Paul Shanley on the stand. He wanted to hear the prosecution's case first and then make a decision.
Give us a little taste of what it's like in the courtroom. Who's in there watching this trial?
Well, Paul Shanley is there every day at the defense table wearing a coat and tie. His niece comes frequently, and they talk when the court is on break. So does another longtime friend of Shanley's, a man he's known for many years. And then there's a woman who's there who was a victim of Father James Porter of Fall River. Father Porter was the first priest convicted years ago in some of the first clergy sexual abuse cases. So this is a woman who was abused by Porter, went to Paul Shanley to get help, and really respects Paul Shanley because he helped her tremendously, but feels torn and is just drawn to watch this case.
And when is this likely to go to the jury?
It's expected to go to the jury by the end of this week.
Monica Brady Meyerov, thank you.
You're welcome.
Two death penalty cases in Boston are highlighting the question of fairness in how juries are selected, at issue whether black defendants face all-white juries more often than chance should allow. The judge's ruling in the case could affect many current federal and state trials. Here and Now's Martha Biebinger explains.
Brandon Morris and Daryl Green are charged with shooting and killing a rival gang member during a daytime Caribbean festival in Boston in August 2001. The men allegedly orchestrated violence and intimidation to protect a drug trafficking ring. They face at least a dozen federal charges, including murder in the aid of racketeering, which carries the death penalty. Green and Morris deny the crimes and any gang affiliation. Patricia Guerin is one of the attorneys for Morris.
Whether he receives the death penalty or not may be completely dependent upon whether we get a jury that has African Americans on that jury. Even one African American can make a huge difference, and the statistics have shown that.
Guerin says the number of African Americans who respond to jury notices in the federal Eastern District of Massachusetts is half what it should be, based on the latest U.S. Census. But that difference translates to just 3.8%, a disparity prosecutors argue isn't high enough to justify a violation of the constitutional right to a fair jury. The judge in this case, Nancy Gertner, says that while she knows the disparity standard is deeply flawed, she is not prepared to re-examine it. Still, defense attorney Guerin says she'll continue to press for methods that give statistically small minorities more weight in jury selection.
The court has been reluctant to look at the situation of cities that have a very high African American population, but they're in the midst of a very white jurisdiction. And so you don't get the extraordinary numbers of underrepresentation, but the result is just as stark. You still get all white juries.
For now, the jury composition challenge in the Morris and Green death penalty cases is moving forward on one issue, whether cities and towns gather accurate lists. Municipal clerks are supposed to update their census every year. State and federal juries are drawn from those updated submissions. Chief Judge of the District Court in Massachusetts, William Young, says it's the only federal district that uses resident lists rather than voter registration or motor vehicle lists.
I understand the challenges about whether the census is accurate, and I express no comment about that. But organizationally, we're the nation's leader, because all the studies show that the voting lists are less inclusive, less open to minorities than the Massachusetts approach.
Defense attorneys for Morris and Green say if the resident lists aren't accurate, in cities in particular, then the chance of having minority jurors drops. Studies across the country find many reasons that urban residents have lower jury participation rates than do people who live in suburbs. In the cities, residents are more likely to be non-English speakers, have jobs that don't compensate for jury service, or have a felony record and can't serve. They also move frequently and don't receive jury notices. The defense expert, Professor Andrew Beveridge of Queens College in New York, says the impact of jury notices that come back because the address is wrong or that just are not returned is dramatic.
If we use Dorchester and Sudbury as the example, it turns out that if you live in Dorchester, you have almost one-third the chance of being on the jury than if you live in Sudbury. So a resident of Sudbury has three times the chance of being on jury as a resident of Dorchester.
Beveridge, on behalf of the defense, has proposed a remedy.
So what we would do is we would adjust the mailings to reflect that. We use a weighted mailing, and so then residents in Dorchester would then have an equal chance with residents in Sudbury.
The U.S. Attorney's Office declined several requests to be interviewed for this story. In court documents, prosecutors object to Beveridge's suggested remedy and to the data used by the defense. They say Judge Gertner cannot impose a change that would send more jury notices to some towns and less to others because it would violate the requirement that residents have an equally random chance of being selected for jury. The idea of sending more jury notices to certain communities to try to balance minority representation is not being used by any federal courts in the U.S. It is being tested by two county courts, one in California and one in Michigan. Paula Hannaford-Agor is a court research consultant with the National Center for State Courts.
Courts are really struggling for which is the better approach. Do you meddle with random cross-section, which is, you know, there's nothing more fundamental about how the jury system works than random selection, or do you look at the outcomes and say, our jury pool really doesn't look like our community, and we need to take some steps to remedy that?
In the Green and Morris cases, federal prosecutors argue that Gertner can't change the rules on her own. The district court can amend the jury plan if the changes are approved by a judicial council of the appeals court. So any order from Gertner would likely be contingent upon that approval. Gertner has asked attorneys in those death penalty cases to determine if there are substantial violations on the part of cities and towns that submit lists for the jury pool, and to devise a remedy if necessary. As this motion to dismiss the charges on the basis of unfair jury selection continues, prosecutors are appealing a landmark ruling Gertner has already delivered. In November, she ruled for the first time in the country that two juries be impaneled in death penalty cases. The first would decide if Green and Morris are guilty, the second whether they would be put to death.
WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Corporate America is riding a new wave of mega mergers, and some analysts predict the ride will be a long one. 2005 is expected to be the hottest year for mergers and acquisitions in a long time. In January alone, Procter & Gamble bought Gillette, SBC Communications acquired AT&T, and MetLife purchased Travelers Insurance from Citigroup. Here and Now's business reporter Mark Mills joins us now to talk about the deals. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Bob.
Why are we seeing so many mergers these days?
Well, you know, a lot of companies are sitting on big hoards of cash. They've made a lot of profits in the last few years, and they're looking to grow. And the fastest way to grow may be to buy a competitor, the way Oracle bought PeopleSoft, or buy a company that's in a different industry, the way Procter & Gamble bought Gillette, and you can grow that way more quickly than if you try to do it internally just by cost savings and increasing your own line of business.
So do we read all these deals as a sign of a good economy?
Usually it is a sign of a good economy. If companies are feeling confident that there is growth potential ahead, they want to expand their business, it's a good time for them to bulk up and enjoy the ride of a stronger economy. It is also seen as a positive for the economy. Of course, the deals can begin to become self-fulfilling. They kind of spawn more deals. If you're a CEO at one company and your big competitor scores some giant headline deal, you start wondering whether you should be making a move. And so we end up sometimes seeing other companies follow suit. And certainly speculation has begun about other companies such as Verizon following the SBC AT&T deal.
You know, every one of these deals is announced with great fanfare, but they don't always succeed. And the case in point being the America Online-Time Warner merger a few years ago in 2000.
That was probably the disaster deal of the century. As a matter of fact, Time Warner stock peaked in the low 70s right after that deal, low 70s per share. You can pick up a Time Warner share today for $18. So 5 years later, that's what that deal has gotten. Often they don't work out. It's true. Sometimes there's a miscalculation and the industry changes and things don't pan out the way they expected, or a company may have paid too much. Sometimes the corporate cultures don't sync up very well and the synergies that everybody thought would be there don't materialize. And sometimes deals end up getting unwound later on when they say, well, this didn't work out and we're going to have to spin the thing off.
You use the word synergies. In many of these deals, we hear that word used, and we hear the word opportunities for, or the phrase opportunities for cost cutting used. Red flags for employees. Does a big year for mergers mean a bad year for workers?
It's going to mean a bad year for some workers, that's for sure. There always are layoffs associated with these big deals. I mean, the whole point of this thing is to take two entities, put them together, find the efficiencies, and bring in the same or greater revenue at lower cost, which means more profits. But you've got to keep some perspective on this, even though, for example, the Gillette P&G deal will result in 6,000 layoffs. Last year, all of the mergers and acquisitions resulted in about 66,000 workers getting canned as a result of the deals. But the economy created a net plus of more than 2 million jobs. So, yeah, if you're one of those people who gets your pink slip, it's not good, but it doesn't happen to that many workers.
The point of view of consumers, what's the corporate buying binge mean to them?
Well, this is mostly about the businesses, the executives, the shareholders, and to some extent the employees. Generally, these things don't have great impact or benefit to consumers. In fact, the government regulators have to make sure these deals don't create an anti-competitive environment that leads to higher prices. So consumers need to be protected. If you have a weak company that gets taken over by a strong company, maybe the customers of the weaker company get some better deals and may see some improvement. But for the most part, this is not something where consumers look back years later and say, gee, that was really a great deal. I'm glad they did that merger. There isn't that much in it for consumers.
Okay. Here and Now's business reporter Mark Mills, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Bob.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo is no ordinary classical dancing troupe. The trocs, as they're known, are all male, they dance on point, in size 10 toe shoes, and they wear tutus, imitating swan queens and sylphs, hairy chests and all. Yes, comedy and spoofing ballet is their business, but they're serious about ballet technique. And as New Yorker dance critic Joan Acacella recently pointed out, the trocs are, quote, delivering more bang for the buck than most other classical companies in America. The trocs are now touring the country in their 30th anniversary season. In 2002, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with trocs artistic director Tori Dobrin as the troupe rehearsed in Carnegie Hall.
The company was formed in 1974 by a group of guys who wanted to have fun with ballet conventions. And they had no idea that it was going to last for the almost 30 years that it's lasted, I'm sure. Consequently, when they were making up the name, they were making up a name that was funny, that also had some relationship to the different ballet roosts de Monte Carlo that were circulating the globe. So they concocted this name of Le Ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo. So the name doesn't have really any sense at all.
Except it harkens back to an era of sort of traveling ballet companies with terrific glamour.
That's exactly it.
Troc star Paul Gieselin was tying on his toe shoes. I asked him how he got his fake Russian stage name, Miss Ida Nevesayneva.
Everybody gets their names chosen for them. Sometimes they're given to people who seem to fit their names. Like, there was this guy who, he just looked very Dutch, so we called him Mini Van Driver. The thing that drew me to the company was the humor, taking on characters. I just loved that about the company. I mean, the guys are dancers first and foremost, but the great thing about it was these great characters. I do a lot of dying swans. I have died all over this great vast world of ours.
The Dying Swan, it has got to be the most famous ballet solo, and the trocs do it in a very distinctive way.
I hate to give away our beauty secrets, but, you know, we have the ballerina, and somehow the tutu is, like, molting throughout the entire piece. It just seems to be this endless supply of feathers falling all over the stage. It's quite beautiful. It's quite poetic.
This is a very serious technique, and you all take it very seriously. How does it become funny?
Well, I mean, the humor isn't something that you really have to work on when you've got a guy in a tutu and lashes, tiaras, and the whole bit. It's just inherently funny. So, you know, when we do jumps, we do big jumps. But like in a female variation, you won't see a female end a variation with a bravura jump. Whereas we'll do a well-executed female variation at the end, double tour to the knee, which is very exciting for an audience.
And completely surprising.
Completely shocking.
My real name is Robert Carter. I'm Olga Sapozova and Yuri Smirnov, my ballerina character. I have chosen to make her more glamorous. I wear a blonde wig, you know, and because of the level of my technique, I don't necessarily go on stage and have my character overshadow my technique or cheapen what it is I'm doing. I try and make everything as soft and as fluid as possible because that's more feminine. Most people are going to always look more often than not at the upper part of the body. So when you're dancing female roles especially, because that is a quality that most ballerinas have to have, it's very calm upper body and arms have to be very soft and very fluid and very exact.
It's also part of the humor to have a ballerina.
It's here to have a little body here, you know, to see a pretty, you know, ballerina step up on stage in hairy armpits, you know. It's like, you know, and then some of them have hairy chests, you know, even a couple of them have hair on their back.
Is this a choice? Is it advice that the director gives you?
It's a choice. He likes us to try and be as close as possible to the description of man doing ballerina, so that it's very evident that we are men.
I'm here with one of the stars of the Trots, Nadia Rombova. What's your real name?
Jai Williams.
You have to be one of the tallest dancers I've ever seen. How tall are you?
When I'm on point, I'm like 6'5", maybe, yeah, 6'5", 6'6".
That's pretty imposing.
Yeah. If I ever do any pas de work, the guy has to be really tall.
Or really small for fun.
Small for the funny, you know, joke part of it. It's really hard at times. And I have to, you know, really make sure that I'm on top of everything, because if I'm off, I'm going to fall, because the little guy can't hold me up, you know. Point technique is really hard, because as a male dancer, you're not trained to dance on point. So when you start dancing on point, it's really, really hard, and you have to learn how to get your 6'6" body up on this tiny little, like, 2-inch platform and, like, do things and balance, and you have to, like, make it look easy.
In this company, there's a fine line between serious and funny. And where's that line for you? How would you describe it?
It's all serious, and it's all funny at the same time.
I'm Raffaele Morra, and I'm from Italy.
When you dance a beautiful Giselle-type, soft, feminine role, do people find that funny? Or is it meant to be serious?
Oh, well, I try to do that in the most serious way, because we are already funny, because we are men in tutu. I'm not one of those people that says we try to do the ballerina steps and they will forget we are men in tutu. They will never forget them. They will always remember that we are men in tutu.
Here and Now's Lynn Menegon produced our piece. The Trocs perform in Salt Lake City tonight. They'll be in Scottsdale, Arizona on Saturday. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oakes. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.